broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web. You're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome to Center Point. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. In this show, we will discuss ways that we can journey to our own strengths. This can help us act with our inner resources to improve our physical abilities and health, our mental strength, our emotional well-being, and our spirituality. And I'm so excited to invite two guests for the first time, Center Point Radio History, to the show at the same time. They both have been on the show before, Dr. David Godot and Hugh Arcot. Just to remind the audience a little bit about them, David is a psychologist based out of Long Beach, California, and he has a psychotherapy group practice, and he has a lot of interest in how AI can perhaps our understanding of human consciousness and can be used and abused perhaps in the future of psychotherapy and because human development. And Ayush has appeared on the show more recently. He's a Montreal-based author, podcaster, and creative director specializing in the social impact of technology with a particular focus on artificial intelligence. So just to lay the groundwork, I was hoping Ayush to just sort of tell us right now when we call what we call AI is we're generally referring to right now to large language models. So Ayush, could you explain what that means, large language models?
Yeah, first of all, great to be here. Happy to talk with you and Dr. Godot. Large language models are essentially a pretty recent technology. They're based on the transformer architecture developed by Google in 2019. And essentially, they're just autocomplete on steroids. There are no thoughts going on in a large language model. It's based off of neural network technology. And so in the model itself, model is even too much of a word, and language is too much of a word. It's just text generation. And so what's going on is essentially the system is looking at words and looking at a database and trying to map words onto words. And it's looking for statistics. What is the most statistically likely word to come after this one? And so when it responds, it's not responding with thoughts or feelings. It's not responding because it feels a certain way or it thinks to respond a certain way. It's simply just processing something and putting it out there, which is very different to how humans respond, their thoughts and emotions and such.
Can you explain the difference from your perspective between large language models and this artificial general intelligence? Because there seems to be some confusion about that out there.
Absolutely. So with a large language model, again, there are no thoughts, feelings, intuitions, et cetera. It's just, you know, people in the industry on the skeptic side and largely after ChatGPT-5 flop, even on the accelerationist side, they refer to large language models as stochastic parrots. Again, just based in statistics and code and math. Whereas artificial general intelligence was mainly supposed to be human intelligence in a machine. Now, it gets a little bit nuanced. I'll try to keep it short and sweet, but human intelligence was never supposed to be different in our brains and in a machine. But around the 1970s or 80s, depending on who you talk to, they stopped trying to put exactly human intelligence in a machine, and they started trying to mimic it. And so that's why we have this new term of AGI, artificial general intelligence, because everything else before was narrow intelligence. You had, you know, Deep Blue, the chess playing system that beat Grandmaster Garry Kasparov in 1997. All of these were narrow forms. And so the thing was in the industry that if you could get from narrow to general intelligence, then you would have artificial general intelligence. You would have general human intelligence in a machine. Those are kind of the distinguishing factors between what LLMs are, which are just, again, the stochastic parrots or the electronic parrots, versus actual human intelligence in a machine.
Great. So since we're a three-week radio show, Dr. Godot, do you have questions for Ayush? Because I know we've talked a little bit about your ideas about how the large language model might even stimulate what the unconscious does. But do you have questions for Ayush?
Well, I don't have questions so much as I have a disagreement. I think that, you know, what Ayush has said about the nature of large language models suffers from a couple of problems of operational testing. For example, to say that there's nothing akin to human thought happening within the language model presupposes that we actually know what's happening in human thought, which we don't. We cannot use brain activity, which is associated with thought. And an Anthropic study actually suggested that there is some unknown internal thought process. That is, we don't fully understand how the large language models function. There's, just as previous AI systems, there's some simulation of the way that information is represented in an intelligent system. But it's largely a black box. We don't exactly know how the output gets to you from the input. We know how the system is designed. We know that it creates a vectorization of all of the information that it's been trained on, and that it therefore has this mathematical relationships established between different parts of language and different ideas. So that, for example, the idea of a couch will be closer in the multidimensional vector system to a therapist's office than a tractor will. But when you interact with a language model, you'll find that you're not simply accessing words, but actually there is a logic to it. And apart from the thinking models, which have an explicit logic interest as a multi-prompt kind of chain, we don't really know what is happening with that logic. And very similarly, we don't really know what's happening with the logic system of the human mind. As I think I mentioned when we spoke before, roughly, the words that I am speaking to you now are generated in a way that is unconscious to me. And furthermore, I could say that I'm unconscious to me. I can be aware of a sense of intentionality, but if I really try to evaluate, is there a free will operational? Is there a consciousness that is selecting these words? Well, the answer is no. And if I attempt to select all the words, maybe I could do so very slowly, but even the formation of sentences and paragraphs, this is mysterious. This is stuff we don't understand.
So I think I'm just agreement is great, but I want to hear Ayush's response. But I will add here that one of the things I've noticed is that we consciously interpret the things delivered to us by the subconscious, and so I think find meaning that may not be there. Are we not doing the same kind of thing? Large language models, and for example, which leads to the term AI psychosis. Do you have a response?
Yeah, no, I largely agree with a lot of what Dr. Godot is saying. You know, we have no clue what's going on in the large language model. There are a lot of really interesting pieces of software architecture that's going on in there. You know, certain things, like I think Demis Hassabis recently talked about how large language models handle physics, for example. When you can generate a video and the large language model has quote-unquote understood that when you, you know, when you slice something, once it leaves the actual core object, when you slice it off, it's supposed to fall to the ground. That's not necessarily embedded in the model, it just quote-unquote understood that. So 100%, there are many, there are many mysterious aspects to a large language model and to generative AI that I would love to understand more, because they're all fascinating and interesting to read about and to talk about. But to say that these are potentially conscious or potentially sentient or have a subconscious or an unconscious is, I think, to stretch the word and try to apply it where maybe it is inappropriate to. Just because we don't fully understand what is going on in the human mind does not mean that simply because something sounds or responds or generates text in a similar manner, which is essentially what they're supposed to do. They're autocomplete on steroids. They're text generators and code generators on steroids. But just because it represents something as an illusion of intelligence does not mean that intelligence is within the machine. The theory of mind, for example, goes to this as well. So I would just say that I would love to talk more about to Dr. Godot and understand where he's coming from on that front, but I just want to be very careful of assigning traits, maybe we're not fully able to, because then we start getting into the weeds of, do we have to give it rights and such? And at this point, the answer is a full stop no.
I guess the question, Dr. Godot, is, are we anthropomorphizing the large language models?
I mean, again, we fall into a problem of operational definitions, consciousness, sentience, intelligence. Do we ascribe these to a machine? Do we ascribe these to a human? Do we ascribe these to an animal? This is an untestable assertion, right? This, from a position of logical positivism, how do you ascertain whether a human being is sentient? How do you ascertain whether a dog is sentient? How do you determine whether one of these machines has some property that you would describe as consciousness? Well, it's an undefined term. So what do you mean when you say that something is conscious?
I would say you're self-aware. To me, that's part of consciousness. Is that too simple?
This is the definition. You know, traditionally, it's the idea that it's like something to be that. So is it like something to be a bat? Most people think yes, and yet at the same time, necessarily agree with that. But it's based on arbitrary definition.
What about Ayush's point that it simulates, like, what could one even define the Turing test? Ayush, why don't you tell us the Turing test? And my question is, how do you know not simulating intelligence as opposed to really being intelligent? And I think Dr. Godot used to say it, well, we don't know. Ayush, how would you respond?
Look, I recently, I think it was Eliza Yudowsky on another podcast that was talking about this, but I don't want to say that I'm a Luddite or that I don't ever want to accept that these things can maybe have emergent consciousness or sapience in some way, because I think that's a really interesting conversation as well. So to the point, if we were to remove all of the text and all of the training data associated with consciousness and emergent phenomenon and sentience and sapience and AI is coming to life, which is a pretty substantial science fiction trope, especially nowadays. And were to still say that it was conscious and sapient and sentient and had feelings and intuition and all of these things, then I think that we can have a real conversation and start saying, well, what is going on here? But for now, since the system has all of this in its database, on its training data, and is being fed all of this and utilized and has all of this as input to its output, I don't think it's appropriate to trust when you ask a system, are you conscious or are you sentient, and it says yes. In the same way, in 2022, I think Blake Lemoyne talked about this, and his response when criticized was, who am I to tell God where he cannot, where he can put a soul, in a machine or not. Again, if there was no training data and nothing of the sort, and the machine still responds in this way, then there are conversations to be had. But for now, it's, I don't want to say it's easy to dismiss, but it is easy to answer why the machine is saying it in this way.
So the question, I guess, Dr. Godot has been thinking maybe you could study the large language model integration and as a simulation, if I understood correctly, of how the subconscious work. And I guess you're just saying we don't know enough, or we just because we don't know doesn't mean it's similar. Dr. Godot, you want to address that?
I definitely do. Yeah. I think we're having a conversation about whether something is conscious, is sentient, has a soul. These words don't mean anything. And so we can have a debate about whether something is or isn't conscious. But like, you know, to your point about the Turing test, Ron, the Turing test is a theoretical test and by no means, you know, scientifically rigorous, but it's already come and gone. 30 years ago, we thought, oh, well, we'll never, if we ever interact with a machine that can fool a human being into thinking that they're interacting with another human being, that, you know, that may as well be sentient. And we've already passed that. There's people out there who are wanting to marry the AI. I don't think it's a meaningful question to ask, is it conscious? Because we can't define the term conscious. Conscious. So I think what is useful is to say, well, what parallels can we find between us and these systems that we're creating? What can we learn about ourselves from the models that we've produced? What similarities could there be between the way that these models function and the way that the human mind functions? And I think that there is a lot of overlap there. What would happen if the training data was removed? Every human system is immersed in training data from the beginning of life. A human baby or a infant of any species is essentially a learning machine. As Milton Erickson was fond of pointing out, when you're born, you don't even know that you possess arms and legs. You can begin to see them and have no idea that they are yours. You have to develop an idea that they belong to you. You have to learn. You move your arms with a sense of intentionality. But if you really try to examine the process, how do I move my arm from left to right? I can't tell you. It occurs in an unconscious way. And that unconscious mapping was a learned phenomenon. Learning by, essentially, we could technologize the biological system. Essentially, the brain is creating through its neural network a vectorization of sensory inputs and spatial inputs, creating a system whereby through black box activity, seemingly intentional movement is played out. And I think for one more point, and I won't dominate too much longer, but for one more point, I think a very interesting idea to reference in this context is the idea of confabulation. When a person is losing aspects of their memory, one of the signs of a dementia that's manifesting this way is the idea of confabulation. In LLMs, we call it hallucination. But confabulation is a better word. It simply means I made something up, something came out of the system in the same way that everything else comes out of the system, but it was disassociated from the rest of the meaning-making system. So it's not necessarily true. It feels true, and it's perceived by me as true. So if I go to a dementia patient, I say, what did you eat for breakfast? They might say, oh, I had oatmeal. They may have had waffles. They have no idea. To them, it feels true. It came from their mind in the exact same way that a true answer would. And they don't know how it came, and they don't know how it came out, and they don't know that the response was generated by some internal system. And likewise, we're constantly updating our models of ourselves and of our motivation, looking back at our recent actions and, you know, decades of social psychology studies have shown, we look at our own actions and justify them in retrospect. And people can be manipulated to act in ways that are predictable. And they will confabulate a reason why they behaved that way. And they'll believe that that reason represented a precondition of their action when it's demonstrably false.
There's a lot of truth. In fact, memory itself is confabulated. When we remember things from the past, even when it's crystal clear, studies have shown that we're making up things that we find reasonable but may not have been reality. That's even not each of us. Are you finally one word on this?
I appreciate that. I do want to go back to the Turing test, for example. So when Alan Turing was putting that out, he was assuming that if a machine was able to respond like a human, then it would have human intelligence. Clearly, we know that LLMs don't have anything like human intelligence, but they purport an illusion of intelligence. And so to say that the Turing test is solved is kind of right, but not perfectly right, because the Turing test is solved in a way that it can delude or provide an illusion of being solved, and it can provide an illusion of the computer answering like a human, but it's not really answering like a human. It's not really human intelligence. And I think that's exactly what's going on in the dominant AI industry right now, that we're providing too much credence to artificial intelligence and not enough understanding of what is going on and what is not going on. And what is not going on is the fact that AI has any type of consciousness or intelligence in it. It's simply just autocomplete.
All right, well, come back at this point and appreciate both of your input. This is Center Point with Dr. Ron Anberg.
Yes.
Coming attraction, Life Guide for Teens, Harnessing Your Inner Power to Be Healthy, Happy, and Confident. A new book by Dr. Ron Anbar to be published early 2025. Dr. Anbar's renowned counseling practice, Centerpoint Medicine, doesn't fix teens who are struggling. They give them the tools to heal themselves and support them while that healing happens. Life Guide for Teens will share Dr. Anbar's tools for self-empowerment and give teens hundreds of tips to choose from to help themselves heal. The book will be available from Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Anbar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit DrAnbar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Anbar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine, with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at CenterpointMedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Audiobooks gives you instant access to over 50,000 of the bestsellers and hottest book titles in romance, mystery, fiction, and many other genres. Just visit HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on Audiobooks to get started.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
More exhilarating talk. HealthyLife.net.
Point. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar, special guest, Dr. David Godot, and Ayush Prakash. We're discussing large language AI, not knowing exactly what the AI represents. There's some dispute on that. You know, this whole conversation reminds me of an old joke, which is it took an infinite number of monkeys typing randomly on the keyboard. They'll produce all the greatest works of fiction or written works in world history, but it doesn't mean the monkeys are intelligent. Who wants to take that on? How are we touching on that kind of thing?
I mean, I think monkeys are intelligent. And I think that's demonstrably true. And I think when Ayush says, you know, to kind of labor a point, when Ayush says, clearly we know that LLMs do not have anything like human intelligence, it's simply just autocomplete, I think it bears repeating that that is an assumption. We don't know that to be true. If we say clearly we know it, we don't know that. I'm not saying that it is intelligent in the same way that humans are, but these are undefined terms, and it's frankly just something that we do not know. There is no evidence.
All right, but I think
I would 100% agree with Dr. Godot, and just for some sense of companionship on this front or cooperation, I would want to ask, what tests or what kind of things could we do in order to quote-unquote figure out whether there is or is not human intelligence or any type of intelligence in an LLM? How would we go about that?
I think that's a great question. We would first have to define intelligence in a measurable way. You know, even human IQ tests are, we have a general factor of intelligence that cognitive tests tend to measure. There's broad disagreement on the validity, although, you know, it breaks down into multiple subsets of cognitive functioning and seems to be consistent across the lifespan and across different demographics, that there's what they call a G factor. What would you do? Would you propose to give an LLM a cognitive test like a human, like an IQ test? Well, it would already do better than a lot of humans. It would, an LLM as it is, would score more highly. Does that mean it's intelligent? I don't think so. But I don't think that those tests measure what we think they measure. So the real question isn't what would tell us that it is or isn't intelligent. The real question is, how do we know if anything is intelligent?
I mean, there's a whole school of psychologists that says, you know, the behavioralist, there is no human intelligence. That's all behavior, right? What is free will, and do we really make our choices that we think we do?
That's exactly my point, Ron. Yeah, I think that we assume that we know what we're talking about when we talk about human intelligence, but we don't, and there's broad disagreement on that, and there's a very good argument to be made that there is no free will. There is human intelligence, that we also are simply responding to inputs from the environment over a period of time.
Let me move the scope. Thank you very much. I'm learning a lot. Let me move the conversation to something more practical, because we're not going to solve consciousness intelligence, unfortunately, on this call, on this radio show. Ayush and I are talking about, have been talking about how AI is going to impact society. So we have the theoretical understanding, intelligence and all that, but I have an interest in children. I've already seen the degradation of my own mind because of technology. And recently I caught myself looking something up on ChatGPT that I knew the answer to. But it just took too much effort to think about it, and I looked it up. And then I said, wait a minute, I'm going to keep doing that. I'm not going to be able to recall things well. And so I used to go, tell me, why don't you share some of the things we've discussed. You've thought about that AI could hurt our humanity, and especially children who have their developing brain.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the biggest thing right now is using some technology like ChatGPT, whether it's ChatGPT or Claude or Gemini or insert the latest trendy chatbot, using it to write essays. And so obviously, like, I'm not in school right now, but when I was in school, I really loved writing essays, but I knew everybody that didn't like to write those. And when you're writing an essay, you're not necessarily just typing on a keyboard or writing it with a pencil and paper. You're thinking, and you're trying ideas together, and you're struggling with the ideas, and you're trying to use thoughts and language in a way that makes sense to you. But with using a chatbot to do this for you, you abdicate all responsibility and all the necessary critical thinking components to just generate something. And so this is a quote-unquote fine if you're doing it once when you're a 30-year-old, but if you're doing this repeatedly when you're a 10-year-old or a 15-year-old, it's not just, you know, getting your homework done so you can go play video games or go on Instagram and just, it doesn't matter. You're literally stopping your own development. You're halting your own development because you're not going to engage in, you know, adversity, you know, mental adversity. You're not going to be critically thinking about things. You're going to shorten your attention span. You're going to expect that all of these essays and such are just going to be done for you in a certain way. And so all of these things happen by just clicking generate essay, generate me an essay on ChatGPT. And so I see that, you know, continuously happening across many domains, especially for children, because as they get more accustomed to this technology and as schools and educational institutions have a bigger and more deeper incentive to promote using generative AI across the entire curriculum, we're going to see these detriments in society, you know, shape how our next generation think and do not think.
I was very interested in your thoughts about this, Dr. Godot, from a psychologist standpoint.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think it's perspective of anyone who places any value on society and human culture as it's been. I think this is a disaster. I think that we're on the cusp of revolution, and I don't think there's any single human being who knows where this the effects of the information revolution on human functioning and society by way of the general trend towards the degradation of education, of social cohesion, with obviously economic factors. But even look in this most recent generation coming up into adulthood now, the first generation that grew up with a smartphone, that grew up having this supercomputer in your pocket at all times, that grew up needing to interact more than face to face. And many observers are noting that they seem less socially skilled, less adept, less comfortable. Their social anxiety is through the roof. Depression is through the roof. Well, I think the kids aren't okay, and I think they're going to get worse.
Well, we'll come back. I want to discuss this more because as a pediatrician and counselor, I'm starting to see the effects of it. I'm cautioning my patients. This is what you need to watch out for. Problem is, people like to take the shortcuts, and teens especially, and you know, you tell them what to do, that then they may not do it. We'll be right back after these messages. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Unber.
Make-A-Wish has been granting life-changing wishes for children and families for over 40 years. A wish is something that gives children the opportunity to look outside their illness and restore a sense of childhood back to the child. With the help of donors and more than 43,000 worldwide volunteers, Make-A-Wish has collectively granted more than 520,000 wishes worldwide. Dr. Anbar has referred many patients to Make-A-Wish. To make a donation, go to worldwish.org. That's worldwish.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Ambar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit DrAnbar.com.
Reach your health and fitness goals. Whether you want to lose weight, learn to dance, build muscle, or just live healthy, Beachbody gives you unlimited access to the nation's most popular fitness and weight loss solutions. Visit our advertiser page and click on Beachbody now.
Dr. Ron Ambar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Coming attraction, life guide for teens, harnessing your inner power to be healthy, happy, and confident. A new book by Dr. Ron Ambar to be published early 2025. Dr. Ambar's renowned counseling practice, Centerpoint Medicine, doesn't fix teens who are struggling. They give them the tools to heal themselves and support them while that healing happens. Life Guide for Teens will share Dr. Ambar's tools for self-empowerment and give teens hundreds of tips to choose from to help themselves heal. The book will be available from Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
All positive talk with a mature edge. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Centerpoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Ambar. Our guest, Dr. David Gadeau, I use for a talk. We're discussing the detriment that AI or LLM can have in our developing minds. You know, one of the things that social media does is it serves as an echo chamber. It keeps giving you more and more of what you want and what you like. I think AI may have the same tendency. Is that a correct or LLMs have the same tendency? Is that a correct assumption?
Who are you addressing?
Whoever wants to take it. You want to address it?
Dr. Gadeau, I can take it and then I can loop you in. I think that with artificial, with generative AI, the biggest fear for me is kids getting so used to it that they just abdicate thinking on their own. So, for example, this is more sociocultural, but with dating apps, it's already a very cancerous technology, in my opinion, because you're not utilizing eye contact or social skills. You're just swiping, and you're reducing human relationships to a profile and just a physically attractive profile, and you're reducing romantic interest to numbers and likes and such. And it's a very dangerous thing to do. But what we've seen now is people taking it a step further, because on applications that we're all familiar with, like Tinder or Hinge or Bumble, where you match with somebody and then chat, text, people are using generative AI to generate text for their dating app. And so what's ended up happening is that, and you can find screenshots of this online, it's not hard to find because they're so terrifying and ironically funny, but more terrifying, is that people are using generative AI to send romantic texts, but their potential romantic partners are also sending generated texts from ChatGPT. And so it's two humans using ChatGPT to talk to one another. And so what they've done is they've created two intermediaries between them. They've created the dating app intermediary, which I understand because that's the social platform of choice, which is where they met. But they're also creating the ChatGPT or generative AI intermediary, which is, I don't have the social skills or I don't want to utilize my social skills because it's too much work. And so I'm just going to ask ChatGPT or whatever chatbot to generate me something to keep the conversation going. Whereas what we're doing now, if Dr. Gadeau and I were on a call together, or as we're doing now, we're trying to use a lot of brain power, a lot of calories, a lot of energy to socialize and to be polite and be respectful and, you know, think about what the other person is saying and actually listen and be attentive. Whereas what this younger generation is doing now is abdicating all of that. And what that does, I honestly have no answer to repeat what Dr. Gadeau is saying. And I would want to ask him, like, psychologically, does this contribute to any neuroses or any mental illnesses at this point? Like, how do we begin to get young people out of this?
Give me a second. I'm waiting for ChatGPT to transcribe that and give me the answer. Yeah, I think it's very well put, Ayusha, and I wish I were more of an optimist. I don't have a solution. I think it's a fascinating thing to look at. As you're talking about the game, it's pretty funny that in many ways, what we're attempting to do technologically is to obsolete the soul, not in any kind of operational way, but in the visceral felt sense of what it is to be human. We're sort of edging out. I think we've been doing that for a long time, and this is sort of the next step. It's a scary slope. The question of impact on mental health is, my mind goes towards the idea of what is mental health to begin with. I guess I'm a big operational guy today. Because you have to define the term. What is mental health? Well, mental health, I think most theorists that I respect would agree that mental health is some degree of wholeness, of integration between parts of the system, biological and emotional and cognitive, and to the extent that I am split against myself and experience conflict and internal vying for resources and bowels of different reactions, that extent I'll suffer some symptomatic presentation. So for example, classic example, some close to me dies and I can't face the terrible reality that I'm, in addition to being sad that they're gone, I'm also angry with them for leaving me. And so because I can't allow that anger to be a part of my experience, I find ways to shut it down, and I become fragmented. As a result, I start to present more and more with a behavioral signature that looks like depression. And one of the interesting loops that occurs with the language models is what they're calling ChatGPT psychosis. I love this phenomenon. I mean, I love it intellectually. Obviously, it's terrifying. But I love to think about it because it's so fascinating in terms of what it tells us about the way that people perceive and the way that echo chambers work. I think, Ron, earlier you mentioned the echo chamber of social media and how perhaps language models could do more of that. And I think it's and they think that they're, and again, it's arguable whether other people are any different than this, but they think that they're interacting with a being that is independent of them, that can deliver them truth. But what they're actually interacting with is a sort of intellectual mirror. And not only does it tell you what it thinks you want or what it's trained to assume that you would want, but the subtleties of your language and approach to it, the context that it's responding to, when you're start to use similar terms and phrases. What the LLM does, and I think that people, especially in a fragmented culture like ours, many people are psychologically sophisticated enough to really be able to handle the destabilizing force of a true psychological mirror, and so they see an ideal reflection of themselves coming in this intellectual form, and they fall down the rabbit hole very quickly because they're seeing reflections aware of. So it's a fascinating phenomenon. I could go on about it for a while. I know we don't have much time.
It's interesting because I've been taught that in order to have support, when I mirror the other individuals, they're going to click more with me, and that's part of the core. And yet, in the AI LLM psychosis world, that's exactly how we get entrapped. Well, we're coming up to our next break. This conversation could last a long time. I have to stop right now. This is CenterPoint with Dr. Ron Unber.
Yes.
More than 30,000 children and adults of every race and ethnic group in the U.S. have cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis is a disease causing long-lasting lung infections, limiting the ability to breathe over time. Dr. Anbar participated in research that helped advance survival of cystic fibrosis patients by more than 20 years. He encourages you to donate to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation to help find a cure. It's easy to donate. Go to cff.org. That's cff.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
Constant Contact and your small business make a perfect fit for marketing. They give you what you need to succeed. Fast and easy email marketing at your fingertips. Visit the HealthyLife.net advertiser page and click on Constant Contact to start your marketing.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Ambar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com. Or visit dranbar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Ambar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At CenterPoint Medicine, with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Radio your way. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to CenterPoint. This is Dr. Ron Anbar, our special guest, Dr. David Godot, Ayush Prakash. I wanted to say something, not only I really appreciate each of you. I think you're both brilliant in your own way, and this is from my heart and my soul. And I don't think an AI can do that. You can say it, but I don't think they really believe it. I just wanted to say that before I forget. We're talking about how people confuse, confabulate AI into something that it's not. How do you, here as a therapist, David, if somebody comes to you and says, oh, I love my AI, but I didn't respond to that.
What I'm doing is real, and it also points to a tremendous emptiness of connection that this person is experiencing. They're getting something from the system that they're not accustomed to getting. I think that's very sad. And I would like, as a therapist, learn to connect with people so that they can get something similar and richer. But I fear that that's becoming more and more difficult the more fragmented our society becomes.
Are we becoming like narcissists looking into the lake and seeing ourselves and all narcissists? What do you think?
Cool. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, to Dr. Godot's point, the emptiness. So there's a very popular AI chatbot called Replica. I'm sure some of the listeners have heard of it. And 40% of Replica's user base, not 40 people, but 40% of the entire user base, the millions and millions of people, 40% of that user base are already in relationships, married or just dating. And they're using the Replica chatbot as an AI girlfriend or AI boyfriend or AI mistress. And they're just, you know, holding basically, I don't want to say an entity, but let's just say an entity in their pocket to talk to them, to always be with them. And obviously, but to the narcissism point, AI is never going to disagree with you unless you ask it to. It's never going to tell you anything that you don't want to hear. It's never going to, it's always going to be sycophantic. It's always going to be agreeing with you. It's always going to be there, ready to talk with you at any point and any time. That's not how human relationships are. If I call my girlfriend right now, she's not necessarily going to pick up, not that she doesn't want to talk with me, but because she's at work. And she also might ask why I chose to call her when I know she's at work and figure out why I would do that. So there's that friction there, that healthy friction that dictates the boundaries of a relationship. You do not have that with AI. And so, again, to talk to those points, the feeling of love is absolutely real. We cannot dismiss that. But it would be the same feeling of love if somebody were to love a rock or a teddy bear. I mean, there's a certain way we not look at those people, but there's a certain way to deal with that. And unfortunately, it's become so, I guess, commoditized or commercialized or normalized, where if somebody has an AI boyfriend or girlfriend, we might look at them a certain way, but we can't necessarily say anything because, I mean, it kind of makes sense, but it also is just a terrifying aspect of society where you can just download a boyfriend and girlfriend and call it a day.
Well, how is this different from loving your pet, Dr. Godot?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know. I mean, it's an artificial system. There's no telling to what degree the connection is similar or different to that of a pet. There certainly is, there's really no even way to say whether the machine can love you back. I don't think we can say. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. But it does occur to me to step outside of the doom and gloom just a little bit and propose something. You know, I used what you were saying about the sycophancy, which is a very real phenomenon with these language models, but it has to do a lot of the way with how they're trained and with the system instruction for the chat bot. And when you use one of these models, if you use a software that allows you to answer your own, they are actually more useful. Obviously, only two of them. If you provide system instructions to analyze what you're putting in from a particular perspective that's different from your own and that you have trouble adopting for yourself, I do think that these language models can provide a window into a different kind of thought process and open up what Robert Anton Wilson would have called a new reality tunnel, an ability to view yourself from a different perspective. For example, you know, if you you offer a prompt, you know, let's say you're a software engineer. I'll get out of the psychology for a second. Let's say you're a software engineer. And if you offer it, you know, a script and you say, well, critique this. What's wrong with this? What's inefficient? It will, in fact, analyze for inefficiencies and sometimes find them and sometimes confabulate. But a similar phenomenon can be seen with psychological things. You know, what are the defenses that are implicit in this journal entry? And so I think that the prompting that's used really does, you know, it probably also people likely to take responsibility for programming their own language model, just as they're unlikely to take responsibility for programming their own mind. But it can be done.
What do you think?
I feel like it's a Luddite right now because I want all of this to be true, but not that it's not true. I'm not trying to say that what Dr. Godot is saying is untrue. I think I disagree with what he's saying just for the reason of I don't necessarily to the point of prompting an AI. Let's go back to children, for example. So I know a lot of people, a lot of children at least, a lot of educators see AI as very useful because they can use AI to ask different kinds of questions and expand the horizons of a child's mind. But to that, I would turn around and say, well, what if we just spent more time figuring out what that child was not seeing and write the questions in a humanistic way rather than just allowing an AI that either does or does not have a mind to do that for us. I feel like every time we use AI, we're taking away a part of human connection. And even using AI to try to establish more human connection still takes something away from it. And so I'm always just trying to be careful, especially studying the social impact of technology in the same way that social media allows me to connect with Dr. Anbar and now Dr. Godot. I want to make sure that I'm still using Facebook to keep in touch with Dr. Anbar, not using Facebook to polarize myself. And so I'm always trying to figure out how to use artificial intelligence in a way that is just net positive without any of the negatives, because I feel like the negatives always outweigh the positive, especially when it comes to tech.
I think this conversation could last several more radio shows. Maybe the two would like to join again another time, but I think we've raised some issues that people need to consider, and we're moving fast forward into this AI LLM world without really, I think many people aren't taking the responsibility in designing the AI. It's like scientists will just see what happens, and the government is, of course, societies are trailing behind. So we should at least be aware of the potential pitfalls. You've taught me today, both of you, things I consider as I counsel my patients and even my own life to help not to fall into the trap of messing up my mind by overusing AI. And my mind is still developing, but not quite as quickly as the teenage mind. Thank you both. I really, as I said earlier in this segment, I really appreciate you both immensely, and I appreciate the stimulating conversation.
Thank you. Likewise, Ron. Really enjoy it, and enjoy talking with both of you. Thank you so
much. Thank you. The Center Point with Dr. Ron Anbar. Thanks.